When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition, a comic book podcast where we discuss the famous, infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I'm Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Brian Reese.
Hey, Paul Carr.
How are you, Brian?
I'm fantastic. I want to wish you and all of our listeners, in retrospect, because you'll hear this later, a very happy Bloomsday.
A very happy Bloomsday. Not where I thought you were going to go with that.
No, it's Bloomsday.
It is Bloomsday.
Yes.
Let's everyone go get a kidney that tastes like urine.
Yes.
Everyone doesn't know Bloomsday is the celebration of James Joyce's Ulysses. So, you know,
and the very last word in Ulysses is yes.
So everyone go out and be long-winded and say things that are meaningless.
Greatest novel ever written. Okay. Paul disagrees with me.
Okay, look.
Hence the silence and the
I don't particularly care for I don't particularly care for Ulysses, but I acknowledge its importance and its greatness. I just don't like it. So I can you know what? Let's start a petition to get Ulysses rewritten the way I like it.
Oh, well, that's a good idea.
Actually, yeah. We'll probably just, if it was Joyce, he just published the petition.
Poems, all sizes.
All right. Enough of this literary talk. Let's talk about comic books. Which is literary. That's a terrible thing
to say.
Which
is literary.
So anyway, today on the program, we will be discussing the 1987 classic Spider-Man run, Kraven's Last Hunt, written by J.M. DeMatteis with art by Mark Zeck. But before that, there's something happening in the world of comics that we'd like to talk about. And that is, of course, the ending of Vertigo, DC's alternate adult-oriented imprint that has been a mainstay of comics since its launch in 1993.
Sad.
It is sad.
It's alternately sad and probably it's tough because it's at some point it's there is the put a stake in it, but at the same time Vertigo was such an integral part of my return to comics. I had stopped reading comics for a while.
Yeah, I had as well.
I hadn't stopped reading comics. I had stopped, let's say, collecting comics and following comics monthly, and had been reading trades or catching up on old comics, and I had kind of abandoned comics like as a monthly or weekly and every Wednesday exercise.
Exactly. I was in the same boat. That was other factors as well. I mean, for me, I was in my 20s and just other things were going on. But the thing about Vertigo is because I was in my 20s at this time, I don't know about your experience growing up, Brian, but for me, comic books were always kind of looked down upon. They were for kids or just nerds.
Right.
And it wasn't like today where you can just proudly go out and say, I'm a comic book fan.
You can read them on the train or the bus or on, you know, in public on the park bench, and most people weren't going to blink.
Yeah. Well, when I was growing up, that was not the case. You could.
No, you had to kind of.
You could kind of get a whooping for reading a comic book.
Get a whooping, and if you wanted to get a little, you know, bow, chicka, bow, bow,
The ladies weren't rushing to your house because of your comic book collection.
Right, yeah. It's like, hey, baby, you want to see my, you know, it's kind of like wanting to show someone your vinyl collection, you know.
But,
hey, you want to go through my long boxes?
But Vertigo was one of those, when it came out, it was one of those, if you were an obnoxious person like myself, you could start saying, look, it's for grown-ups, see, look at these comic books.
Yes, I only read Vertigo comics.
Yeah. So I was kind of obnoxious using Vertigo as my, trying to validate my comic book love
then. I think we all did that. I think there was, you were certainly not alone in that.
Yeah, but it was necessary. It was a necessary thing because then eventually we all got to the point where, hey, look, I don't have to validate myself because of these other people. You know, it's the Bill Maher's of the world. I don't have to prove myself to you. You're never going to understand what this is all about. So, but there was a time where your ego needed a little bit of a push, and Vertigo was there for us.
It was very much there for this. And I think like what people need to, well, not our listeners who already know the full extent probably of Vertigo, but just a little history. I mean, it was, so Vertigo was essentially created to house Swamp Thing, Doom Patrol, Sandman, Hellblazer, these, which none of those titles started off as Vertigo titles. They were like the DC's, like kind of a mature imprint that didn't really have a home, like, and sort of like, I wonder, and who could tell, but would Watchmen have been published under Vertigo if Vertigo had existed at the time? I don't know. Who knows? But
I would have said yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, it was created, you know, and it was the great Karen Berger.
Oh, yeah.
And the great Shelley Bond, who were the shepherds in this. I mean, Karen Berger, particularly, she was the main editor of Vertigo, and she was the one that fostered Vertigo, and she took over those titles. She took over Sandman. She took over Hellblazer. She took over Swamp Thing, and was instrumental in creating this wonderful imprint that existed not just for more intelligent storytelling. And I don't mean to denigrate the other type of storytelling that was going on at the time, but this, right. I mean, this was storytelling that was specific to, I mean, it was horror. It initially started off, it was mainly to do horror comics, which was right up your alley, right, Paul?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Sandman is what drew me in the first place to Vertigo. You know, that was my doorway in, if you want to call it that. And yeah, anything that was sort of on the, you know, the darker side of comics was usually put into Vertigo, but it expanded beyond that into just, you know, like I said in the introduction, adult oriented, but it was more than that.
It was mature readers. It was more than just maybe showing, you know, a boob.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, yeah. I don't know if that'll get edited out. I mean, you know, but.
No. They showed boobs and dropped an F-bomb from every once in a while.
Right.
But it took
a while for the F-bombs to hit. You had some more mature language. You know, you had, you know, the other word for poop. and you know, those were, I think I've dropped that word a few times in our podcast, so maybe I'm being a little puritanical here by not saying it, but, and I may drop it again later on in our discussion. But, you know, it was in degrees. It was in stages.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you didn't have like the F-bomb thrown out quite as much until one of the most famous Vertigo titles, Preacher.
Oh, yeah.
Which just completely blew stuff up. But it was more than just the potty words.
No, it was more, it was more psychological. And it got, the subject matter was a lot deeper than your average superhero comic,
right?
In the mainstream superhero comics, so the writers and artists were able to just delve a lot deeper into subject matter that usually wasn't the realm of comic books, at least at that time.
Right. And you know, and every writer at 2000 AD, I think, eventually found themselves writing for Vertigo.
Oh yeah, of course.
But you know, it was Vertigo that. Grant Morrison was doing Animal Man before it became Vertigo, and he was doing Doom Patrol. I think actually his entire run of Doom Patrol was pre-Vertigo, and when Doom Patrol moved over to Vertigo, it was Rachel Pollack, I think, that had taken over at that point. But someone can fact-check me on that. But it's weird when we look back at like what comics were pre-Vertigo and then post-Vertigo, and you see some titles that you thought really should have belonged in Vertigo that were not, but were probably instrumental in the creation of that imprint.
Yeah. Well, Sandman is a good example.
Where, right.
You know, where it was just a mainstream comic and then was one of the premier titles to be launched when Vertigo, launched. That along with Hellblazer and Swamp Thing.
But it was the imprint.
Oh yeah,
I think Image is some places like Image have kind of taken over for that. I think that's why we've seen Vertigo suffer. There are certainly issues now. There have been issues for years with Vertigo about who owns the rights.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that because essentially what Image is today, Vertigo is it images the Vertigo of today, essentially.
Right.
So, yeah, I was going to ask you, because I don't really know the ins and outs. I know Vertigo's been having trouble the last few years. They tried to do this big relaunch, which kind of went nowhere.
I think it's because they can't attract the premier writers with their premier stories anymore, because DC still, you know, DC or their parent company, whoever it is this week, you know, there was the rights, the owning of rights changed over the years. So the ability to own rights to characters that you're creating under the Vertigo umbrella changed. Hmm. And, you know, then DC, like at the new 52, then they pulled Hellblazer, John Constantine out. They pulled Swamp Thing out. They pulled a lot of the pre-existing characters that had been in the DC universe prior. They pulled them out of the Vertigo umbrella. And I think creators were getting a much better deal at Image.
Well, it was, yeah,
made more money self-publishing, because Image has a very interesting business model for the creators. And if you hit at Image, you're going to make more money than you make at the majors. But if you don't hit, then you're left. You've seen some creators with some fiscal issues, and that's why you see some Image titles that just disappear.
No, but and Image is given a lot of leeway to, you know, for creators to kind of go a little crazy and right, follow their vision as without a lot of interference. Mm-hmm. And Vertigo used to be that way.
It very much used to be that way, and it was very much hands off. I mean, and again, that's a testament to Berger and Bond, who have both gone on to kind of do some interesting things. I think Berger with Dark Horse, she's got Berger books, and Shelley Bond with, I just lost the name of it, and I've been enjoying those books. The Black Mask.
Black Label?
Yeah, not the Black Label.
Or IDW.
No, it's through IDW. It's
IDW, yeah.
I'm getting most of those titles, and now the name just escaped me. We can edit that in later.
Yeah.
But, you know, both of them were kind of forced out. Not kind of. I think both departures were not necessarily pleasant, which is sad. But, and I'm not saying that the current editors are doing a bad job, but there's just not the appeal. Vertigo does not have the cachet.
Right. That it once did. Yeah.
To attract writers. And some of that has to do with the sort of lack of, sort of the overall grand scheme that a Berger had, where it was a very much a hands-off approach. Like, mm-hmm, the bat penis, and this is part of why, you know, I mean, we can't do this without bat wang, you know, bat a wang, because you see, like, the shift since that happened. You know, DC overreacted to, you know, they misread people making jokes about the Bat-a-Wang, to people being puritanical about it, which I don't think was the case. And I think if this were 20 years ago and Vertigo had published, you know, an alternate Batman that, you know, showed Bruce's little friend, or not so little friend as the case may be, that might have slipped under the radar.
His Batmite.
You know, and I don't mean to revisit that whole, this sordid, you know, but you've seen, like, what DC has pulled back. There's, you know, they pulled back on the black label stuff. There have been rewrites that several authors have had to do. You know, so you have a very gun-shy company right now. And I think it's just there wasn't room for Vertigo. Some of these titles that are existing in Vertigo right now are moving to Black Label.
I was surprised at the time that why do Black Label when you had Vertigo? Why wasn't Batman Damned put into made a Vertigo title?
Well, because I think Vertigo had initially included bits of the DC universe, right? I mean, yeah, even absolutely. In Sandman, you had even up towards the end in the wake, you had DC characters appear. But there was, at some point, like a hard line drawn between, you know, Vertigo and DC shall never coexist.
Yeah, which and, you know, so was Black, arbitrary, Black, I thought, but
right. It was arbitrary. But Black Label, I think, was designed to tell mature reader DC property characters, like DC proper property.
Right. Well, I mean, but what I'm saying is, they already had that title. There was no reason why you couldn't integrate them back in, especially if Vertigo wasn't doing that well. Put the main DC characters, darker stories, back into Vertigo.
Right.
It just seems silly to me to separate them out like that. Because now you don't have the Black Label and you don't have Vertigo.
Well, you still have the Black Label, and from what we've read is like a lot of the Vertigo titles, like in trade, are now going to have the trade dress for Black Label. So they're moving over to that. It's very interesting. We don't have all the information as to how rights are going to revert, what's going to happen to Jason Aaron's scalped.
Yeah, that's a shame.
Is that going to end up at Image? Is he going to retain the rights? Is that going to end up at Image or Marvel? I don't think Marvel doesn't have a platform currently. Max is a joke. I don't even know if anybody's doing Max anymore or Icon at Marvel. But
I think you know, since the Disney merger, they're not really focused on that anymore.
Right? No, because they're having some of the same issues that DC is having with parent companies being a little overly cautious.
Right.
Which is too. Some of it's too bad. Yeah. You know, it's Vertigo has not been great in a good while, and so that's why I think, like you were saying, why not just collapse Black Label into Vertigo? Well, Vertigo has been the name has been tainted for a while. You just have not seen the quality. You have seen some good stuff. Vertigo has put out some consistently good stuff, but it doesn't match what you would consider the glory years of Vertigo, however one views that, you know, from Fables to Why the Last Man to Scalped to DMZ to, you know, the earlier stuff.
You had Invisible's Transmetropolitan.
Transmetropolitan started, we're going further back, but Transmetropolitan started under a different, what was it, Helix? I can't remember for certain, but that was under a separate sort of signage, and then when that collapsed, then Transmet fell into the Vertigo universe and has been trade dressed as Vertigo since then. But the label is, I think the label is tainted, and then it probably was time to shutter Vertigo. But at the same time, man, it's just like there is a whole part of my comic book reading realm that is gone.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about that. So if listeners know, last night we said, let's talk about Vertigo. We were discussing the episode today. And I made the suggestion, hey, why don't we pick our favorite Vertigo titles?
And, impossible.
Yeah. And then I was going through it last night and I just realized, holy crap. There was a time in my life that I was reading almost exclusively Vertigo titles.
Yeah.
You know, there was a portion where the majority of things I was reading was coming out of Vertigo.
And right.
Yeah. But now I was I don't think I'm reading anything in Vertigo right now at all.
The only Vertigo I'm reading right now, I was reading the Sandman stuff. But I had dropped two of them, and I was basically, I was down to Books of Magic and The Dreaming, and I was reading American Carnage. You know, I tried some of the other ones, and it just...
Right. There's so much out there now that you just kind of, you know, you have to stick with the things that are of the highest quality, and I'm sorry, but Vertigo's just not there anymore.
It just wasn't putting it out, and there was no impetus for creators to, like, established creators to bring their properties to Vertigo, and all things must pass. Great sort of publishing, comics publishing endeavors have come and gone, and they put out great stuff, and you know, we come not to bury Vertigo, but we are burying Vertigo. But yeah. we will also, you know, praise that which it has done. I mean, again, an exhaustive, we could do an exhaustive list, and it's almost too difficult to go through. I mean, you know, 100 bullets.
Yeah. Well, just anything, all the Neil Gaiman verse that was there with Books of Magic and Black Orchid or, you know, The Dreaming. There's so much that came out of just Neil Gaiman's niche in Vertigo.
Right.
That's classic. And then there's so, and then plus there's so much, so many other things as well. The Unwritten was great.
The Unwritten, I'm just trying to think of the Exterminators. I don't know if you read The Exterminators.
Yeah, absolutely.
It was a great show. A great comic. You know, there's so many great comics that came out of that world. Shade the Changing Man.
Oh, yeah.
Which is still one of my favorite reads, which is difficult to recommend because it's batshit crazy.
It is. Yeah, well, Vertigo is just such a huge part. It was a very important part of comic book history, because it was a very transitional period from the 80s, starting to get that dark and gritty, and the craziness of the 90s that we talked about just this last episode.
Right.
But then becoming just a much more mature storytelling, more refined artistic styles, and that transitioned into what we have today. Just across the board. And it was Vertigo was an incredibly important part of comic book history. And I'm sorry to see it go.
Yeah. And it would be nice to see, you know, I think there are creators out there who would not be who they are now without Vertigo. And I'm looking at you, Brian K. Vaughan. It didn't hurt these creators to have published some of their seminal work under the Vertigo, you know, name.
All right. Let's take a break, and when we come back, I'm craving some conversation on Spider-Man.
Woo!
It's good stuff, trust me.
It must be Dad Joke Day. Is it Dad Joke Day?
It is Dad Joke Day.
It's not just Bloom's Day, right?
It's not. We are actually recording on Father's Day, so.
Yes.
Yeah, so happy Terrible Joke Day. All right, we're taking a break.
You like cheap comic books, right? Well, I'm Professor Allen. And I talk about cheap comic books on the Quarterbin Podcast. In every episode, I'll dissect a single comic from my collection, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for the issue. Forget about $4 new comics that you can read in 4 minutes, or crossover events that can cost $100 to collect. Join me in the Quarterbin, where even bad comics are a bargain, and good ones are a steal. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Visit us at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search Relatively Geeky or Quarterbin Podcast in iTunes. I guarantee it'll be worth every penny.
And we're back. All right, Brian, so today this is your recommendation, so
'tis.
Let us know what it's all about.
All right. In 1794, William Blake published his most famous poem, The Tiger. Almost 200 years later, in 1987, J.M. DeMatteis and Mike Zeck published via Marvel Comics the 6-part Fearful Symmetry / Kraven's Last Hunt, taking place in Web of Spider-Man issues 31 and 32, The Amazing Spider-Man 293 and 294, and Peter Parker, The Spectacular Spider-Man, numbers 131 and 132. The plot on this story arc is deceptively simple. Kraven the Hunter kills Spider-Man. He takes over as Spider-Man. Vermin eats some people. Spider-Man comes back from the dead. There are a few action sequences and fights. Kraven kills himself, and Spider-Man captures Vermin. But there are a myriad of complexities within this seemingly simple narrative. With Mike Zeck producing some of the best art of his life, including one of the most iconic covers in comics history, DeMatteis weaves a tale rife with concepts of mortality, honor, identity, madness, and yes, compassion, into a whole, a symmetrical narrative, sad and sinister. What makes man? What makes an individual? What sacrifices do we make for our humanity? What is legacy? And who are we in the end? Into all of this, what truly burns the brightest? What fearful eye dares to reflect the nature of our very self? A masterpiece of comics lyricism, Craven's Last Hunt dares to reimagine good and evil, placing into the reader's hands questions that are not answered easily, but stretch the medium and our own perceptions. Sad and horrific, with a conclusion both expected and startling, a journey not heretofore often given in mainstream comics. We give you Craven, The Last Hunt. So, Paul, feelings.
Well, I mean, goodness. What is this is kind of one of those, you know, icons of comic book stories. You know, it's something that's rightfully placed on a pedestal because it's a classic story. I mean, it's incredibly well done. It came at just the right time, just at that turning point of the dark and gritty and the more mature storytelling that we were talking about.
Fitting that we're talking about this as we are also talking about the, you know, collapse of Vertigo.
Yeah. It's almost as if we planned it. spoiler, we didn't actually plan it. It all just sort of came together. but no, this is just a wonderful, wonderful bit of storytelling. It's exciting. It's depressing. I had forgotten. Okay, so I read this many, many years ago, of course.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and then just rereading it again, I had forgotten how dark it got.
It's pretty horrific.
Yeah,
there's in some instances.
Well, just even some of the concepts. I mean, the fact that Peter Parker is buried alive for 2 weeks is
right
awful.
You know, yeah.
That's horrible. The character of Vermin is pathetic and sympathetic, but just also awful.
Right. I think one of the biggest, one of my biggest takes from this is, you know, Vermin is a cannibal. I mean, that's relative in terms of is Vermin human or not, but there's nightmarish scenarios with Vermin.
Yeah, and there's some panels. I want to get into Mike Zeck's art
yes.
in detail here, but there are some panels with Vermin just over, you know, bones and torn apart corpses that are just, oh my God.
I don't think I can ever hear the word yum again.
Yes.
Without having some nightmares.
Goodness gracious. Yeah. So there's that. And then even something like the depiction of Mary Jane, because she, you know, when Peter's missing, she goes through a very difficult time. The man she loves is just missing. She has no idea what happened to him.
Right.
You know, someone's out there pretending to be Peter. I like the fact that she immediately knows it's not him. There's a lot of stories that would have, you know, had her saying, oh, what happened to my husband? What happened to Peter? But no, she immediately knows this isn't him.
Right.
We don't have to have that whole aspect. Yeah. It psychologically, this is a very deep story. Boy, where do you want to start with this?
Right. It's difficult because it's hard to know where to start. So so we start at the very beginning, right?
Yeah, there you go.
So essentially, which I reference, I mean, the story itself is, I think, very intentionally basic.
Yeah.
And I don't mean that as, you know, the plot lines, the narrative structure. Well, let me take that back, because the narrative structure is actually pretty fascinating. There's a reason why symmetry is a word that we can use often in not just the original reference material, but in how even the panels are laid out.
Yeah, the story plays with time in a truly, you know, fascinating way.
Yeah.
That was not being done at that time and very rarely done now, actually.
So, I think what we have to start off with is, so essentially, and we don't know this until the very end, but spoiler alert for what that's worth, Kraven is dying. And Kraven is a fascinating character throughout, you know, his run in Marvel Comics, and in that he is a villain and he is a hunter, of course. He is not a villain because he is a hunter, but he is a hunter who is a villain. And so he essentially decides, right, that Spider-Man represents something that is more than just Spider-Man, more than just a person in a costume, you know, zipping around New York City, cracking jokes. And
right. It's his one prey that eluded him. That was it. Right. That got the better of him.
And Kraven is known for a person who prefers to hunt with his hands and with, you know, handmade. He doesn't use guns. You know, the thrill of the hunt is about, you know, the individual versus, you know, everything is done. I want to say manually,
done physically instead of,
right. It's the physical
mechanically.
Battle.
Yeah.
It's the strength versus strength.
Right.
And the wiles versus the wiles, and not necessarily taking his prey out with a weapon from afar.
Yeah, he wants to take his prey out in the manner that, yeah, in the same way the prey, he wants to emulate the prey.
So Kraven is obsessed with, you know, and it, like I said, there are things about honor and family. Family plays a very important part too, but Kraven has zeroed in on Spider-Man as a mythical being that is more than the sum of its parts, to be generic about it. So he has devised a plan with which he is going to become the spider. Now, Kraven is out of his mind on drugs. he's taking drugs.
Yeah. Yeah. He's got, and it's funny. There are several scenes where he realizes, hey, maybe I shouldn't be taking this much. These much hallucinogens, you know.
Well, and his character has always depended on sort of herbal remedies and altered states of consciousness. But in this, his altered states of consciousness are ramped up. And some of this, it's not explicitly stated, but you wonder if some of this is based on whatever physical pain he's going through.
Yeah, and then that should be noted that there's a lot of concepts here that are sort of thrown out there, but not, I think, intentionally not elaborated on, so that, you know, we're left to infer quite a bit.
DeMatteis trusts the reader.
Exactly.
And I think one of the other great things about DeMatteis trusting the reader is, I don't know if you notice this, there are no thought balloons.
Yes. That's a point I'm actually going to bring up when we get to the art. So,
okay.
Yeah.
And of course this is sort of standard now, but at the time thought balloons were being used. So you have an internal narrative that is visually represented, not with thought balloons, but with a very poetic. I referenced William Blake at the beginning of this. I think William Blake's poem is important. William Blake's poem, you know, the tiger, tiger, burning bright, in which case this is spider, spider, burning bright, is thematically, it bookends the comic, and it's important. And
it's woven throughout the storyline.
Right. And it is, I would certainly, it's not a long poem. You can easily find it anywhere on the web. If one hasn't read The Tiger by William Blake, it will take you 2 minutes to read it. It'll take you a lot longer to understand, you know, well, not to understand it, but to fully contextualize it. But okay.
So we might as well get into my thoughts on the narrative text boxes.
Sure.
I know you lament the demise of the thought balloon.
Yes and no. I mean, I lament it because it was fun.
Yeah. But the way the narrative text boxes are used here, they're used to just great effect. The thoughts are broken up into multiple panels, layered on top of one another. Certain characters' internal dialogues are broken into splits, like someone's subconscious mind affecting their conscious mind. They're thinking about something, but then their subconscious keeps chiming in. But it's layered upon it. You know, all these thoughts are layered on top of each other.
And you see that with Peter Parker. And the question is, and I don't remember, you know, I'm not a Spider-Man scholar. I don't remember at what point the symbiote becomes the consciousness of the symbiote and Spider-Man. So this is the black symbiote costume that Spider-Man is wearing in this. And I meant to research this. I didn't, but I don't know how important it is. So
I don't think that's a thing yet. I could be completely off base here. I don't think that Venom, for lack, you know, the symbiote becomes, is actually affecting him right now in this storyline. I could be wrong about that, but even if I am, I don't think it matters.
I think
this should be taken as a standalone story and not try to.
The only reason it comes up is because Peter Parker's internal dialogue is used with two different colored panels.
But so is Mary Jane's. Mary Jane starts thinking about things, and then her subconscious chimes in every once in a while, like Peter's dead, and she tries to brush those thoughts away. So I think it's the story itself is trying to play on the idea of everyone has a dual nature, mm-hmm. even if it's just our conscious mind and our subconscious mind. But Kraven has his, you know, his humanity, his honor, but then his also his bestial side.
Right.
And Spider-Man is, of course, Peter Parker and Spider-Man. So it plays quite a bit on the duality of every person. I know that might be highfalutin, but it's really well done in this story. Well,
but I don't think it's not really. And if it is, it's DeMatteis is doing this on purpose. And again, he's busting the reader.
Yeah, it's used too often. I mean, even Vermin has his his humanity and his beast side. So every character has a dual nature. So it's not just, it's too obvious to be a coincidence. So Kraven's plan, it's a pretty simple plan.
Right.
Kill Spider-Man and be better. Well, yeah, as we see it progress, it seems as if his plan is to kill Spider-Man and then replace him and in his mind become a better version of Spider-Man.
Right. But of course we find out that it's deeper than that and not exactly what we have been given to believe. Go ahead.
Well, here's something that, you know, and maybe I misread this or didn't notice it. When Kraven becomes the Spider-Man persona, when he dons the mask and becomes a vicious version of Spider-Man, does he have Spider-Man's powers or is he just mimicking them?
Well, I mean, that's where it gets tricky. I as reading it, I do not remember a scenario when he actually exhibits any of Spider-Man's powers, Peter Parker Spider-Man's powers. I think what he exhibits is his own, because Kraven is a physical specimen himself.
Right.
So could Kraven climb a wall? Could Kraven swing on webbing? Yes. I mean, he could do all these things without having Peter Parker Spider-Man's powers.
But it's inferred several times by characters.
He doesn't remember, you know, he doesn't show like tingling spider sense.
No, but it's just, it was inferred several times that he was Spider-Man. And I wasn't sure if, it got me confused saying like,
right, but I think that's the internalized, like how much is real? You know, I realize that we're getting deep, but how much of, particularly with Kraven, how much of this is real and how much of this is
a delusion that he's having?
A delusion, or how much of this is drug induced? How much of this is You know, even the Peter Parker bits, you know, where Peter Piker picked a pick.
To Pecker?
Is not a Peter a Pecker. How much of what we are reading is real and how much of it is imagined? And I think we cannot solve that here. And I think every reader of this can bring their own experiences and their own sort of view into this.
Yeah. Yeah, because Craven is obviously having hallucinations at points. You know, I mean, it's obvious.
And Peter Parker is having hallucinations also, as one will when they've been drugged and buried for 2 weeks. And again, we're giving something away. Peter Parker's not dead.
Well, no.
I think we've clarified that. And I think anybody who's read comics for the past 30 years knows that Peter Parker is still alive.
Yes. Peter Parker, but I was actually surprised at, I'd forgotten how long Spider-Man was removed from the story. I mean, this is 6 issues and he's gone for a full 2 issues. Well, I mean, but as far as issues,
he doesn't even appear. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just Craven and Mary Jane and Vermin as being the main characters. Right. I forgot. When I thought when you mentioned this story and I thought back to it, I was like, oh yeah, he gets buried alive. And he's gone for 1 issue, but he comes right back. But then I was like, oh, wait, he's still gone.
Right.
It's the story.
It's supposed to be like 2 weeks, I believe, that he's you know, in this state. And of course, you get that great moment, like at the end of, is it issue 3, issue 4, the hand coming up out of the grave.
Well, yes, there's just so, that's a really great sequence of flashing back and forth between the burial, him climbing out of it, him imagining himself in tunnels, and it's all Mike Zeck. His artwork is fantastic in this.
Yeah, I think we cannot. Mike Zeck has done great work throughout his comics career, but this is, if not the highlight, certainly one of the highlights.
Yeah, I found a quote by DeMatteis that said, "Because Mike nailed the plot elements so perfectly in his pencils, every action, every emotion, everything was there, clear as a bell. I didn't have to worry about belaboring elements in captions or dialogue. I was free to do those interior monologues that were so important to the story. If any other artist had drawn Craven's last time, it wouldn't have been the same story."
That's a great quote. And that's it, just reading this, I mean, that is so accurate to we, the reader's response. I'm not advocating reader response criticism by any stretch. But we, the readers, you know, see that. And, you know, it's great that, like, when a writer and an artist's vision is also able to be mirrored within the reader's experience.
Yeah, we've talked about this on this program before. But when an artist and a writer are just clicking, when they're working together, it becomes a symbiotic kind of relationship.
Yeah,
I know. But it can take comic books to a different realm. I'm being overly romantic, I think, but it becomes something really, really special because you have the great writing by DeMatteis, but Mark Zeck's artwork allows that writing to flourish, and that's what really makes this storyline so impressive. Is the art is really conveying this split personality, the duality, the dark corruption of every what's going on, in ways that mere dialogue can't.
Right, and I think, you know, it goes back to you know, we talk about, again, I hate to harp on structure, but the structure is so important to this story, and it's not just in the, not just DeMatteis' writing, which is so well structured and with it, and it's in very distinct acts that feed on one another, but like Zeck's art, I mean, some of the best work that you see are the occasional panel at the bottom of the page.
Exactly. Like, for instance, you know, I think you're speaking of the Gravedigger,
which you see in the first issue of the series and you see in the last issue of the series.
Right.
And it's a shuck, you know, and you get the sound and
Yeah, so that's what I kind of mentioned earlier, is just the way this story plays with time. You're watching, because the Gravedigger is actually happening at a later time.
Right.
So we see things, it's not really progressing, the story isn't really progressing in a linear way. It keeps going back and forth through time. So in the very first issue, it throws you off balance, that you don't really know. You know, there were certain things that happened after what we thought was happening before. I'm not explaining that well.
No, I mean, it's, yeah.
But everything's kind of going off in a different, in different time periods.
Right.
It all becomes clear towards the end. And that Gravedigger is one of those things that you keep seeing it over and over and over again. And it's just, you keep saying, why is that there? Why is that there? And when you get to the end of the issue, you say, oh, this is, now I see. But then there's other things, like you were mentioning at just the bottom of the pages, a spider and a rat,
which is the middle two
exactly
issues you have, and they're just random panels. They're not on every page, but they're placed appropriately within the action. And the middle two, the bottom panels, are, yes, it's you have a spider and a rat on Spider-Man's grave. You know, here lies Spider-Man killed by Kraven the Hunter, or what have you. And you know, then you have the spiders increasing, like, yes, in on the grave, and suddenly the grave is covered in spiders. You know, and they're just these little inserted bottom of the page panels that tell a story of their own, but mirror the story being told in the rest of the comic
without directly informing us that Peter's life is coming back to him.
Right.
You know, so the spiders increase, which means his strength increases, which means he's going to be coming back. But they're not saying that directly. It's actually quite clever.
It's just structurally, like, great. It's just structurally impressive.
Yes.
And whether that was a directive from DeMatteis or Mike Zeck left to his own devices, who can tell? Only Mike Zeck or JM DeMatteis can tell, and I would assume that neither one of them would take the opportunity to claim credit on what is such a great collaborative effort.
Right. Oh, yes. And that's the key to this, is that they are working so well together, and that's what makes this really, really shine. It takes it from being a really good story to being a classic story, an excellent, great story. And just, there's so much, I can't praise Zach enough in this. I mean, just the way Kraven is depicted in his, because Kraven's always been plain.
He seems to be naked a lot.
Well, hey, if I had that body, I think I'd be naked quite a bit.
there's a lot of naked in these issues for a mainstream comic. And we talked about Vertigo. This was mainstream. This was the premier Spider-Man event for two or three months.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, But
there's a lot of Peter Parker almost naked, and there's a lot of Kraven. We get butts to make things lighter for a minute. There are actually real butts in this. Just on a humorous note, like, there's real butts. You weren't allowed to. How did they show this? I mean, this isn't my primary concern, but I think it should be pointed out that in 1987, on a mainstream, you know, comic book that you could buy at your local drugstore, there's butts. And if folks have any other takeaway from this, I hope this is the most important one.
Yes. Yes. It's our cheeky take on
Spider-Man. Don't be an ass, Paul.
Okay. But the way Kraven is depicted here, because usually he's a hunter. He's a hunter, plain and simple. An eccentric one, but he's usually just a hunter. But here, he's animal-like. He's feral. He's a beast. And that just makes him seem more creepy and dangerous and just odd and off-putting. It really makes Kraven something beyond the typical supervillain that you...
Sure, but there are also hints, like, right from the beginning, that all is not what it seems.
Yeah.
With Kraven, in terms of, you know, the generic take is, you know, he wants to just take over for Spider-Man to prove that he's better than Spider-Man. You know, there's so much more going on, you know, from the fact that he never unmasks Spider-Man.
Yeah. Like
after he kills him, he never unmasks Spider-Man, because it's not important for him to know what is under the mask. what is under the mask is not important. It is the idea of Spider-Man and the idea of the spider. And we also start off, you know, it's like, it's Craven giving this long monologue about his family. You know, family is such, you know, the concept of family is such an important, from Mary Jane reacting to, from Peter Parker being like, his major concern is who is going to die next. Is it, and this is repeated throughout, again, symmetry. He's repeating this throughout the run is, you know, is it Aunt May? Is it Mary Jane?
Is it himself?
But his concern about himself seems is lessened than, you have Peter Parker ruminating on family. You have Craven ruminating on family. We get the whole history basically of where Craven is from. We get his origin story without having to go through 10 pages of you know, let's look back at the history of Craven. No, he's telling it to us. He's telling it to us in his own perception of who his family were, what they mean, and how that has shaped who he is and how he reacts to what he feels are his lessers. And we find out later, like, so we think that, you know, it's almost set up for us to think that Craven thinks that Peter Parker is his lesser. Peter Parker, Spider-Man, the person under the mask, is his lesser. And as we find out in the end, Craven was not trying to be greater than Spider-Man. He was, I'm trying to think how to say this right. He was trying to be the equal to Spider-Man.
Well, that was a little bit complex there. Right there.
Yeah,
well, that was a bit complex because he was trying to be better than to show that, you know, I am greater than you. I can be a better Spider-Man than you. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my take on this was that because of the way Peter reacted to certain things, he realized, oh, I'm not better than you. I am, you know, you're greater than I thought you were.
But when you read that last couple issues and you see him talking, it's Parker's reaction to the thing that ultimately we think changes Craven's opinion of Spider-Man is exactly what Craven was hoping for Spider-Man
to do. And
the reaction that Craven was hoping from Spider-Man. That's my take on it. Yeah. So, I guess we could say what it is. It's Spider-Man spares Vermin's life.
Right. Yeah. So in Craven's mind, his humanity is what makes him a superhero, not the superpowers.
It elevates Spider-Man.
Yeah. And that's, you know, just in general, we as readers know it's not his superpowers that makes him a superhero. It's his sense of responsibility.
It's the Peter Parker that we as readers have loved throughout the years. And, you know, it's a different Peter Parker. There's no funny jokes.
Yeah. He actually reprimands himself for making a joke at one
point.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of conflict going on in Peter's soul. And again, that is that duality again. Mm-hmm. He's trying to be the same Spider-Man, but he knows he's not the same. There's things going on in his life that he's being driven in different directions, and he doesn't quite know how to handle that. And there's the symbology that DeMatteis is using here. He dies to himself and then is reborn. I mean, I know that's cliched, but it's done to great effect here.
Yeah.
He even dies to the community because Craven basically ruins his reputation, and then his reputation is reborn again at the end when Craven
is saved by Craven.
Yeah,
yeah. A couple quick. We should talk about the end, particularly Craven, and
we can give it a shot.
Oh,
sorry, too soon.
Here, I was gonna suggest we put like a public service announcement at the end of this because I wonder if those panels in the fifth issue of this, I wonder if those could be published today.
They are they're pretty graphic, for sure.
Right, but it's not so much the graphic because we don't see the bullet.
But isn't that kind of worse though? I mean, you see,
right? It's the Hitchcock effect.
Exactly, it's what we don't see and what we imagine that makes it
more horrifying than the same way with Yum.
So we should say, I guess, you know, Craven does kill himself.
Right. And there is a, you know, and it's leading up to it. And Craven's having his internal monologue. You see it coming. And you see Craven put a shotgun into his mouth.
And then it cuts to the finger on the trigger.
Right. And then there's thunder or something, you know, you get the crackoom, and then you see Craven's body lying in the casket that he has prepared for himself, which then subsequently is buried by his people or what have you. But it's a very harrowing group of panels. And I wonder in this day and age in a mainstream comic, I think there has been some issues with that. I think there's a recent Incredible Hulk, right? Or whatever the Hulk
is. The Immortal Hulk, yeah.
Where a couple scenes have been edited out.
Exactly. The Immortal Hulk is not shying away from depictions of violence. And it has been taken some criticism. You're absolutely right about that. So this, it's artfully done. It is horrible, and it's heart wrenching. But at the same time, it is artfully done,
right?
And it's not gratuitous. It is something that is necessary to the storyline. So it's tough to say whether it would be printed today.
But it's a rough, because you're almost on Craven's side at the end, because Craven has figured out his life. He has figured out his place in it, and he is making, you know, if we assume that he is dying, he is making a decision as to the where and when of his death. And, you know, people can argue ad nauseum. I'm not here to do that. But in the way it's presented, he has found, via his interaction with Spider-Man and Peter Parker and all of these things, he has seemingly found the answers in his life that he was looking for, and has decided that this then is the terminus of his life. Again, I'm saying this without further comment in terms of philosophically, theologically, et cetera, on this, but I am saying that Damanis and Zek present this scene in a very compelling and very interesting way that you can't read, no matter what your stance on things are, without being affected.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. But that's
don't see that much in comics, because it's amoral.
Exactly. And that's something that's, you know, throughout, you get Craven's character himself. He's despicable, but then we actually sympathize with him as the story goes on. Even though he's doing terrible things, we sympathize with Vermin. Vermin is horrible and disgusting. We feel sorry for him, because he's obviously has been psychologically traumatized. That doesn't excuse him eating people.
and Vermin has like probably the most horrific scenes.
Oh yeah,
in this comic, like when he the whole bits with the manhole covers, which is played once in a horrific fashion and once with humor. It's played several times, but once is one of the only laugh out loud moments, and the other one is one of the most oh my god moments. And it's, you know, it's this woman walking, right? And you see the manhole cover come, or she trips. A rat trips her, and you just see the manhole cover open and Vermin's hand reaching out and dragging this woman down the manhole cover.
Clawing at the street.
And then you have the letterbox that just says, yum.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. it's nightmarish.
Yes, there's a lot of imagery in this that is nightmarish. This is a straight up horror story.
It is, yeah. And so you have that with Vermin, and later on you see him surrounded by the bones of this woman, and the rats are eating it too. You also have that scene where the cop is covered, like he sends his rats to what you think is just, you know, they're you see this cop's body go under a sea of rats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
There's some pretty horrific imagery that goes on in here. Testament again to Mark Zek's artwork. It can make your skin crawl like this. But at the same time, the way the dialogue is presented for Vermin, we actually begin to you begin to sympathize and feel sorry for him, that he's been tortured like this. He's been kind of manipulated into being this horrible thing. There's no redemption arc, don't get me wrong, but
no,
yeah,
I mean, but the you get into the nature versus nurture, you get into all kinds of things here. It's like, is Vermin, you know, is Vermin only doing that which Vermin has been bred to do? And, you know, again, I'm not, you know, offering answers to this, but it's bad things were done to the person who eventually became Vermin.
Oh, absolutely. And by the same token, we see Peter Parker, you know, we love Spider-Man. Everyone loves and wants Spider-Man to win. At the same time, he's doing things and saying things that kind of shed a bad light on him.
Yeah.
From time to time. So nobody is exactly perfect in this story.
But
again,
but
it's really well done. You don't,
the way
you're always on your back foot. You don't know what's going to happen.
Right. And the way they build up Vermin as this horrific creature and then are able to flip our sympathies when Vermin is eventually captured by Kraven and on purpose and put in this, you know, electrified cage. And this is what builds up, you know, the change in, like, so it's Spider-Man's reaction to that, to this despicable character that, again, as we've said, it changes Kraven's thoughts on Spider-Man and who it is. And the fact that Spider-Man can show a sympathy for
yes.
a living creature, despite the horrific things that this living creature has been doing.
And it definitely shows Peter's humanity, that he's going to save this creature, even though it seems at times that the creature doesn't want to be saved.
And he also, of course, Peter Parker, Spider-Man, does not hold back in taking joy in punching the living crap out of Vermin either.
Yeah, which is what I was trying to get at with. Peter does some things here that, you know, we're not on board with, that he's not the full sympathetic hero that we've come to expect. This is a very complex story. There's a lot going on here. So do you have any final thoughts on this one, Ryan?
Well, I mean, I think we've covered, there's more we could cover. There's so much that happens in this, and I can't even begin to recommend this highly enough. Hopefully we did our job encouraging people to go back and look at this. But I just think this is one of the more powerful arcs that I have ever read in comics. And I include that up there with the so-called more seminal events like Watchmen or what have you. I think it has a stronger emotional pull and impact than, say, a Dark Knight Returns or any of that sort of thing. So I just really feel like this comic is why we read comics. And, you know, particularly in light of our discussing Vertigo, which we've mentioned before, it just seems like this could easily have been an early on Vertigo title in terms of thematically, artistically, and you know, so it's reading it after all these years, and it has been a while since I had read this again, it holds up in every way, shape, and form. And almost even now as an adult reading it, when I was much younger, I read this when it first came out, as an adult reading it now, I take so much more away from this than I ever caught as a kid.
Yeah,
I don't know if you had the same experience. But
no, absolutely. I agree with that 100%. I mean, this is, it's one of those seminal works in comic books, and it gets a lot of praise, and it deserves that praise, and it deserves to be in the pantheon of great comic book story arcs. It's incredibly impactful and incredibly, you know, rereading it again, it reinforces how really well done this is. It's one of those examples of what makes comic books great, why this as a medium can do things that no other medium can. And it can
exactly
express ideas and imagery. And it's really just, it's just an incredible piece of work. And anyone who hasn't read it, why are you listening to this? Go read it. But yeah, it's one of those things that many people talk about trying to adapt this into a film or on TV. I think it's not that it's not possible. It's
but
just,
why?
Yeah, but it would take away from the impact of the way that this works because of the medium of comics.
Good. Yeah, which I think that's an excellent point. Trying to do it in another form it just can't work.
I mean, you could do an adaptation, but it's going to detract from the power and the impact of what this is. This is a great example of what makes comics great. So there you go.
we're in tune on this one.
Yeah. Thanks for recommending this. It was really great to revisit it, and it actually gets better the more you read it, the more you can take away from it. It's,
right, because I read this through like four or five times, and again just over the past couple of weeks, and each time was like I noticed something different, and there was a stronger emotional pull as opposed to a lessening to it, which, you know, it says a lot, you know, because once the shock is over, then you get into the deeper thematic aspects of it. And again, as part of your homework, kids, read the William Blake poem, which bookends this. It's used, he changes tiger to spider, but there's a reason why he uses that. And I think it gives a different reading.
And if you're reading William Blake, read the illuminated versions of it that he did himself. He's the original comic book creator.
Yeah, there you go. Yes, true. Mm-hmm. One of the
so I think that's it.
Okay, so this was my recommendation, and since we are a collective and we like to take turns, I believe the next person in line would be Mr. Paul Carr. Do you have a recommendation for us for our next exciting round of the collected edition?
Absolutely, I do. In honor of Vertigo, I have chosen The Losers. So we're going to be doing book one, which covers the arcs Anti-Up and Double Down. This, of course, is the Vertigo title created by Andy Diggle with artwork by Jock.
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 And also relevant because we just a few weeks ago did another comic that featured the Losers.
Oh, that's right. We did.
Yes.
Yes, we did indeed.
You know what that is, Paul?
Symmetry?
It's symmetry.
Yes. Yes, it's almost like we planned this out. We don't. It just sort of happens.
Everybody knows we don't.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, so that's it. So
I'm excited to read this again. I remember really enjoying it. I've got the trades still, so.
So I guess that's it. Thanks for everybody for listening. Please, we love your feedback. Hit us up on our website, collectededitionpodcast.com, where you can leave comments on individual episodes or contact us on Twitter, Collected Ed Pod. That's Collected ED Pod. And we have an end tag. You can get all that stuff.
Yeah.
Just pause it in the end tag. You can get all that stuff.
And someday I'll do a twit.
Do it. So anyway, again, thanks for listening, everybody. And until next time, keep reading comics.
And be well.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter @CollectedEdPod. That's Collected, EDPOD. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?